Hello and welcome to Movie Challenge Accepted. I'm Jason.
I am Marco.
And we're back for another episode. This will be our second one. And once again, we took on two movies that we probably wouldn't have seen had we not had this podcast. But I guess that's the whole idea of this thing, isn't it?
That is definitely the idea. And this one was definitely one I would never even have thought of ever.
Well, you gave me 2012's Joss Whedon written and directed The Avengers.
Yeah, you're definitely getting some volleyballs here. You're welcome.
Debatable, but okay. And I gave you David Lynch's 1997 Lost Highway.
Yes, you did. It was definitely interesting.
That's why I tried to go with that movie. And like we had last week we started with the more popular film, Fast Five, which everyone loved.
Everybody loved it.
And I think today we're going to go with we're going to flip it around. So we're going to talk about the arguably more dense movie first, the more difficult movie to watch first. And that would be Lost Highway. What'd you think?
I think that you absolutely nailed it on the head when you said dense. Not only was it difficult to watch, it wasn't hard to watch because it was not like crazy things were happening, but it was difficult to understand. And to start off with, what did I do to upset you that you had to give me this movie? Because it was a slog once again to get through at least the first half, where I was thinking, what is going on? What am I looking at here?
Right.
What's real and what's not?
Right. Well, that's kind of Lynch's thing, is he's constantly exploring the notion of what our reality is and how we perceive our own reality.
I definitely got that by about the 45th minute into this movie. I was really questioning my own reality. As I was watching this film, I watched it yesterday and today. I needed to watch it twice to really get a good sense of what I had seen. And I have to be honest with you, I still had to look it up online to see other people's thoughts about this film, to see if it was the same as mine or to see what other opinions of the film were. And it was vastly different than what I originally thought.
And so that's part of the beauty. Like there's this whole school of thought that believes that David Lynch cannot be fully explained, right? That the goal of a David Lynch movie is for you to feel something, and it is experiential, and you just sort of, it's a mood piece. You just let it wash over you. And there are people that argue that everything that happens in David Lynch movies doesn't necessarily have a meaning. I disagree with that. But I'd be curious to hear what you think.
I, knowing Lynch as little as I do, but knowing his reputation, I would say that it's difficult for me to find the meaning in this film. I know that there are some themes in it about identity, and it. I think that the main character, who is played by Bill Pullman, the great Bill Pullman, he was great. Are you kidding me? Independence Day was a classic film.
Do you know?
He went from Independence Day to this, so I'm not exactly sure what his agent was giving him, but that's fine.
You know what he wanted? He wanted street cred. Are you familiar? Hang on. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the writer David Foster Wallace?
I'm not familiar with him, though. I don't even think I've heard the name.
He wrote a long, very famous story about the making of this movie in which he does not even get to interview David Lynch. But there's a line in here, and regarding Bill Pullman, and I quote, "Whether Lost Highway is a smash hit or not, its atmosphere of tranced menace is going to be really good for Bill Pullman's career. From movies like Sleepless in Seattle and While You Were Sleeping and Casper and Independence Day, I formed this view of Pullman the actor. He's kind of good and decent, but a basically ineffectual guy, an edgeless guy. I've always thought of him as a watered-down version of the already pretty watery Jeff Daniels."
Hmm. I would agree. I would agree, except for he had a little bit of a renaissance in the mid to late 90s, where you and I agree that his movie The Last Seduction with Linda Fiorentino was fantastic.
Yeah, but and he's actually really good in The Last Seduction. He's weird, and he's kind of, he's got like these quirks in the way he speaks, and he makes a lot of choices. So I like Last Seduction a lot.
Right, right. But I definitely, I could definitely see him being a little bit of a watered down Jeff Daniels.
He has no chin.
He definitely has no chin. But he's a striking looking man.
Actors have to have a chin.
I mean, he's a good looking man. Ever since his days on Spaceballs, you definitely knew who he was, or at least you knew who that face was. So
I'll give you that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this was a departure for him.
Yes, it definitely was. I think for many people in this movie, it's a little bit of a departure for Robert Loggia. Not so much Patricia Arquette. I think she had already made a movie that was a little bit considered a little bit out there with True Romance in 1993.
Yep.
So she was spreading herself a little bit with this film, but Balthazar Getty, definitely a little bit avant-garde for him. You know, he had done Lord of the Flies in the early 90s. I'm not sure exactly what else he did, but I know he was in that.
He has a small role in Twin Peaks, The Return. So for whatever reason, Lynch likes working with him.
Yes, yes. I think the person in this film who I was most surprised to see, and it was Richard Pryor in his last appearance on film, which is amazing that the years that he had, 40 years plus on the screen, this was his last one, which is nice that he was able to do something. So they were able to fit him into this.
But he was suffering. He was pretty badly suffering from what, Parkinson's is what I think took him.
MS.
That's right. So. What about, you don't mention Robert Blake?
Well, I was saving that. So I find it very ironic that Mr. Lynch had said that this movie really came from the O.J. Simpson trial, which was weighing heavily on him, he said, when he was writing this film. And O.J., obviously, about a man who, whether you believe so or not, murdered his wife and his lover, and then has Robert Blake in it, in this very strange mystery man role, who ended up murdering his wife just 5-6 years later.
Yep.
So I found that weird also. And there's another little tidbit that I'm sure you would know. Being a retired NYPD detective, you realize that there was a actor in this movie who was a former police officer in the in NYPD.
Yeah, who eventually, I believe, ends up going to jail.
Ended up going to jail in real life and dying in jail for being basically a mob enforcer.
Yeah, he's one of the two. I think he's the heavyset cop. When the two cops come to Bill Pullman and Patricia Arquette's house, after Pullman and Arquette discover the videotapes that are being sent to them, which are videotapes of them in their own home, taken while they're asleep.
Yes, one of those they had no idea.
Yes. Yeah. The heavy set of those two cops is a cop who was the subject of a book entitled, I think it was called Mafia Cop. And he comes from a family of, the whole premise of the book was that he comes from a mafia family, and he was the only one in the family that went clean. And guess what? Turns out not so clean. He did a lot of killing.
So clean.
Killed a lot of people, clean. That guy.
Yes,
yeah.
He did. Yes, he
did. And yeah, he's on camera. There's also a pretty famous story of Lynch hanging out with the LAPD robbery homicide guys when he was researching this, and he grew close to a guy that was working on the Black Dahlia murder case, which
from the late 40s.
Late 40s, early 50s, around there, which is also interesting to me because James Ellroy, who's an author, a prolific author of American crime fiction, he wrote the novel that eventually became L.A. Confidential. Great movie. His mother is a victim of the Black Dahlia killing. Well, there was the Black Dahlia killing, but there were a number of murders around that time. And his mother is an unsolved murder from around that time. So,
wow.
Yeah, there's an odd connection there in terms of some of the pop culture figures that I find very influential.
So I wanted to ask you, is there a particular reason why you've picked two movies now? Out of our first two episodes, you've given me two movies where the first one, there was absolutely no music. not even like theme music, nothing.
Yeah.
And this one, in the first, I'm sorry I didn't write it down, probably about the first 30 to 40 minutes, there is not even, there is nothing, just very subtle sounds in the background of this film until the big changeover where the transformation happens. And then things sort of become more colorful, there's more light, and then definitely some more background music, as thematic as it may be.
Are you saying you did not enjoy the Bill Pullman sax solo, well, to which everyone in a club is dancing like they're in the tunnel circa 1994?
It's funny you say that, because I did write down here that it was a... I've learned that Pullman actually learned how to play that solo. He did not know how to play the sax until he had to learn that. And it was painful. And I'm like, is this jazz? Is this why I don't like jazz? I'm not a jazz person, but apparently that was jazz.
I'm pretty sure that's not jazz. I've heard, I know nothing about jazz. I have a Spotify though, and I haven't heard any jazz that sounds like that. I think that's David Lynch's interpretation of what kind of jazz would film cinematically.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I was in pain listening to that, him play that. And getting back to the detectives, did you not find them to be the most non-interested detectives in the history of film police?
They
wanted to be there.
Right. But again, what I think you get with David Lynch, and if you watch more of his movies, I think you'll see this, is there's a certain unreality to people's performances. Like, you and I don't talk about our thoughts on these movies before we come on the mic, right?
No.
But you did let slip that you have some thoughts about Patricia Arquette's performance.
Yes.
So what I think Lynch does with a lot of his actors is he's going for a very understated, almost unnatural, almost surreal sort of performance. He doesn't want realism. He wants some sort of extreme performative affect to be adopted by his actors, for the most part.
Well, if we're talking about Patricia Arquette, then he definitely gets it with her, because she is, from the beginning to almost the very end of this film, she is soft-spoken to the point that I'm wondering what's wrong with her. She can come off sweet in the beginning of the film. She seems a little, I don't know, what's the word, non-aggressive in the beginning of the film, and ends up being
almost
totally
drugged.
Opposite. Yeah, almost drugged. Yes, like drunk, like she's on something. And let's get this out of the way too. She had the worst Betty Page haircut of all time. It was absolutely horrible. I mean, her bang started in the back of her neck. That's how bad that haircut was.
Do you know that David Lynch is fascinated by the 50s, like America circa 1950s.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that's
the
thing
with
him. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's probably where the haircut came from. And I would imagine a lot of the things that we saw in this film were things that you could draw from the 1950s noir pulp movies and books that were written like this, because this was a neo-noir type film.
Yeah,
I've read that it was one of the scariest films of the 90s. I didn't find it to be scary. What I did think, there was a time in the beginning of towards the beginning of the film where Bill Pullman's character Fred is in his home and he's staring at blackness, just darkness. I couldn't tell if it was a hallway or a mirror. It was just black, and you couldn't tell where he was. And he looking in there, and I swear I half expected the Babadook to come out and scare the crap out of me. That's what I was waiting for.
Yeah, Lynch doesn't do too many jump scares. There's a famous one in Mulholland Drive, which is probably this movie is kind of the dry run for his greatest film, Mulholland Drive. But there's a jump scare in that. He doesn't do jump scares. I actually have a question. We haven't sort of gone through this. This isn't a show where we sort of summarize movies, because we assume that people, you know
right.
what
I've
we're
already
talking
seen
about.
It.
But just as a fun challenge.
Okay.
Try to explain this movie to someone who hasn't seen it in less than a minute. And go.
Honestly, it's a fever dream of a movie. If you liked films like Natural Born Killers, you will like this. It's not as overstated as that, and there's a little bit more of a story to it, but this is that type of movie, and that's it.
That doesn't say anything about what the movie's about. And that isn't that interesting that, like, this is how a movie like this, like, you can't say, it's very hard to say linearly that Bill Pullman is a guy, he's a jazz musician who's in a bad relationship, and him and his wife or girlfriend, I don't think it's clear.
Oh, it's his wife.
It's his wife, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's wife. Yep.
He and his wife start getting these videotapes anonymously that show them sleeping in their own home. They call the cops. And then maybe he kills her?
Well, that's where... Well, if I'm telling somebody this is a movie when you need to see, I would want to not spoil it for them. However, when you say maybe he kills her, I think that that's actually the one thing in this film that is 100% solid and 100% real. It's actually the biggest clue that is given by Pullman himself when he explains why he doesn't like videos or videotapes, or VCR tapes, whatever. And he likes this. And he said, quote, "I like to remember things my own way, how I remember them, not necessarily the way that they happened."
Yes.
So he may be one of those people that changes and warps reality to fit his own image, his own mind, how he wants to see things, what he's comfortable with.
You know who else you could say that about? David Lynch.
I would say that that is almost a David Lynch autobiography watching this film.
I got to say, when the first time I saw this, I've seen this a few times, I still don't know what it all means. Like, there's a lot of scholarship out there on the internet and on YouTube, and there's a few decent channels on YouTube with people that are much smarter than me trying to explain what all the symbols and what all this the symbolism actually means and what Lynch means by the art. Lynch also very famously never talks about his art after it's out there. Right. In interviews, he will not speak about it.
Didn't he say that he agrees with many people's different takes on the film? He says, whatever it is you think it is, it is.
Right. And that's the whole thing with him. And that's kind of what I did with you with our last episode with Tarkovsky, is that this sentiment that great art asks questions, right? And you're not going to sit there and be told an A to B to C story and walk out of there with a clean understanding of what you just saw. And there's plenty of movies that do that that are fine. Like, The Avengers is a good movie. I enjoyed it.
Good. Good. I'm glad.
Yeah, but I also feel like a movie like this is going to stay with you, not just you, but with a viewer, for better or worse, long after you leave it.
See, this is the difference between you and me, is that I don't mind being spoon-fed the plot of a movie. I really do not mind it. Maybe it's because I'm simple-minded that way. Maybe I have other things in my mind. If I'm sitting down for 2 hours to watch a film, I don't really want to have to think that hard about it. This is definitely going to stay with me because I'm going to think about it. Like, what was it about? What was this about? What were they saying here? But God, it feels like I put way too much effort into watching this film and understanding it to the point that you almost get a headache.
Yeah, it demands a lot of the viewer. Like, the first time I see it, when the incident happens where Pullman is in prison and there's some sort of transformation, and Pullman the next day or that night is found by a guard, and he's no longer Bill Pullman, he's no longer Fred Madison. He has since become the Balthazar Getty character, Pete Dayton.
Pete Dayton.
And again, in true Lynchian fashion, Pete Dayton is not supposed to be in prison. He's not Fred Madison. They freak out. And in a beautiful simplification of how the California prison system works, they just let him go.
They just let him go. Yeah,
they absolutely. Just let him go.
We don't know how you got in here, but you can go.
Yeah, just go back to Nick Nolte and your mom. And,
I'm sorry. I have to correct you. It was Gary Busey. In his most understated role ever, in this fever dream of a film, you have Gary Busey acting his absolute best.
Yeah, he was actually excellent in this.
He was, but it could have been anybody. I mean, it could have been a role that anybody. Why Gary? I'm thinking Gary Busey is going to start flipping out on doing an acid trip like he normally does, but he was perfectly fine.
And which is weird, considering that when Gary Busey is the calm center at the hurricane that is your movie, That probably says a lot about what you're about how batshit crazy your movie
is. It's definitely a Lynch movie at that point. Absolutely. As far as the transformation goes, we were talking about, I think that just that's Bill Pullman's Fred character not being able to deal with the reality of his situation. And I'm not ashamed to say that I looked it up afterwards on what people thought of this film, and they really thought that he was being electrocuted. That was his death sentence at that point. And that's what the flashing lights were indicative of.
Yeah, and so, then they would argue that what everything else after that part of the movie is his dying moments.
Yes, pretty much his dying moments of how his reality and his mind really is, as opposed to what is really going on in the real world. Him dying at that moment.
See, you can argue that, and here's the other thing is I don't come here, and I don't look at like Lynchian or avant-garde filmmaking and try to impress whatever I got from a movie onto someone else's take. I think the beauty of something like this is that it can be many things to many people, right?
Right.
So I don't particularly subscribe to that theory.
Okay.
I think it was more about...
See, that to me is another difference between you and me, because that actually makes a lot of sense. It's very simple to understand, and you're looking deeper into it because you think that there's more meaning to it. And maybe that's why we're making Lynch to be this kind of mythical creature. And, you know, we're kind of looking too deep into his movies when he's really just putting it out there like that, in my opinion.
You know, he's given interviews where he swears that he's not intentionally misleading the audience.
Well, he's lying.
and he has said in interviews that you never want to mislead an audience, that you want to give them all the pieces. The audience is like a detective, and you want to give them all the pieces they need in order to decipher the story. Like, he's not being willfully obtuse, he claims.
Well, I mean, I don't know how that's possible. When I had advertised that we were watching these two movies, there was one of our many listeners actually got back to me. His name is Ted Sikowski from Miami, and he messaged me and was telling me that he likes Lynch, but some of his movies are hit and miss. And quote, he said that Lynch tries to be weird just for the sake of being weird sometimes. Unquote, and I could see that.
Yeah, I. And again, I'm not going to argue with anyone when it comes to how they interpret art, and because I think that's the ultimate sort of pretentious asshole sort of maneuver, is you look down your nose at someone else and say, oh, but you don't understand what he's doing. And I get that. There is an essence of Lynch being weird for the sake of weirdness. But
I mean, this movie definitely puts it out there. I mean, the Mystery Man of Robert Blake was... I've really never seen anybody act like that before.
But again, that's the sort of thing that stays with you. Like Blake, remember, Blake also played, he was a child actor, and then he played one of the two killers in Cold Blood.
Yes.
And that was a great performance, and he's awesome in that. But then he sort of fell away, and he was Beretta, and he had kind of fallen off the Hollywood map. And
well, I mean, he was in Money Train with Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot.
Did you miss that one?
I forgot the excellent Snipes Harrelson vehicle, Money Train.
Yes.
But I don't even know when that was, if that was after this. But I mean...
94. It was 94.
94. Okay. So, yeah. So, he had a little bit of a comeback. But the concept of the Mystery Man, literally in his name, is he is never named. He shows up in places... he is he's in multiple places at the party.
At the same time.
Yeah, he tells Fred Madison, he tells the Pullman character, I'm in your house right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get into like what you did. You read some pieces on how people interpret this movie, and I used to do a little bit more of that. Now I'm trying to force myself to bring my own sort of perception onto the more esoteric films that I try to watch, and I don't always, I'm not up to it. Like there are ideas out there that people come up with for interpreting film that I never would get there on my own.
Oh, that's me. I would never think of these things ever. I am much more literal. I need literal. I can't deal with the possibilities that could be one thing or another. I need linear. I need literal. That's my thing when it comes to movies, and that's why doing this show with you is going to help me open up a little bit, but it's going to be a painful road to get there.
Roger Ebert, in his in his review of this movie, which he only gave 2 stars,
yes,
he referred to it that there's no sense to be made of it.
Right.
To try to is to miss the point. What you see is all you get. And I'd like, hey, listen, Roger Ebert knew a hell of a lot more about cinema than I did. But I got to think that when Lynch puts these ideas, and I've read his memoir, Room to Dream, and I've seen a bunch of interviews with him, I've read interviews with him, and he's a big believer in this sort of very deep subconscious, this creative space, just pure creative subconscious. And he swears that when things come to him, then when ideas come to him, all he's trying to do is to evoke an idea that comes to him. And he claims that this is all very subconscious and that it's not like a linear sort of A to B to C path that he takes. Like in Blue Velvet, there's a very famous opening scene in Blue Velvet involving...
Never saw it.
Okay. There's a famous scene in Blue Velvet where it opens with a severed ear in a green grass field.
Gotcha.
And he's spoken many times that was the idea for the movie. And essentially, that single image came to him, and then the rest of the movie is him trying to figure out how to convey that image to the world. Is the Mystery Man, we assume, based on the fact that the Mystery Man has that very anachronistic camcorder that he deploys at the end of the movie.
Yes.
That the Mystery Man is the one sending Bill the images, the videos.
Do I think so? I mean,
I'm curious.
I do think so. I mean, I think that he's the one sending it, but I also don't think that he exists. I think he exists only in the mind of Fred, Bill Pullman's character. I think that the video is the actual only thing that's real. It's solid. It's concrete. It's evidence to show that he did kill his wife because he believed that she was having an affair with Andy, the gentleman that ended up being a porno producer.
Yes. But now, okay, here's a question for you. If Fred Madison is videoing, how is Fred videoing himself asleep?
I believe it's the security cameras that they said that they were not always on.
Even though the camera in the videos that they watched.
Oh, it's moving. It's moving. Yes, it's moving. I'm not sure. I'm not sure now that you think about it. But yeah, you're right. it's because it was moving even when the detectives were watching it. So they said they were keeping an eye on it. And I'm not sure. It's one of those things. I'm positive that the video is the only thing that's real in this film. Up until the point that he is, quote unquote, you know, being electrocuted, being put to his death for the murder and dismemberment of his wife. After that, it's just hallucinations and what he wants his life to be like. He wants to be like Balthazar Getty, who is a young, good-looking, non-impotent man like he feels like he is and actually is.
Right, because there's the opening sex scene with him and Patricia.
Oh, my God. I've never had a sex scene put me to sleep before.
You know, I'm kind of curious now. You're selling me a little bit on the fact that maybe all this happened. The last half of the movie occurs in the dying seconds of his own consciousness.
Or up until that point that he's... I mean, don't forget when he's in his cell, he's looking up at the ceiling. And you'd think that, you know, he's not there just for one day. He's probably thinking this in his mind and making up this grand narrative of what his life really is like outside of that cell. Now, I don't know why... I mean, people. I don't know why he turns into Balthazar Getty, but I mean, that's just and why the cops let him go after that point, and nobody's looking for him. But that's what he feels. That's what he thinks.
You know, as I got older, it took me a long time to embrace that Lynchian sense of unreality that he brings to all of his work. And I only kind of understood it as I got older, that not everything has to be rooted in this firm perception of the reality that I know. And I think maybe there's something to be said within that movie that Madison, Pullman's character, is essentially processing a sense of reality that he knows. And we are seeing some version of that character's reality play out before us.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree. However, unlike you, I am not into the abstract. So a film like this is, perhaps because you've dealt with Lynch or movies like this, unlike you, it takes me a long time to really let this sink in and to really understand what's happening. And I'm just like you. I don't, like you said yourself, you still really don't understand what's happening. A lot of people don't. It put me in that category also, because I still haven't figured it out.
Let me ask you. So we've done two movies now. You've seen Solaris, the yes. Andrei Tarkovsky movie, and you've yes. seen this. Yes. Not to, I don't like reducing films to like, is this one better than that one? But which experience did you enjoy more?
I have to be honest with you. I enjoyed this one more because it's a little bit more present day, which made it a little bit easier for me. But I enjoyed Tarkovsky's minimalist take on the science fiction genre. And it worked for that film. And just like the minimalist first 30 minutes of this film worked for it also. But I do like the fact that it's a little bit more modern noir film. Than so I think I enjoyed this film a little bit more.
You know, you saying that makes me really, we're not going to do it back to back, but there's another movie that a lot of people view as being Lynch's masterpiece, which is Mulholland Drive. And it is very similar in a lot of regards to Lost Highway. So I'm going to be curious, once we get to that down the road, I'm going to be curious to see you compare the two. Mulholland is a little more structured.
Okay.
But it's also quieter. So I'm kind of, and it's funny to hear you say quiet, that this movie was quiet sound wise, because I've always thought that in terms of music and soundtrack, this is one of Lynch's loudest, most bombastic movies.
The first few minutes of this film was no sound at all, until you get to the part where he's in, I mean, he's speaking to his wife. He's very, they're very soft spoken. They're whispering practically to each other in a dark hallway in their home. And then all of a sudden it goes to him playing that, killing people with his saxophone solo that lasted uncomfortably long. And I could see people crapping themselves in the movie theater with surround sound when that happened. So, but other than that, there was nothing. And then after that, also walking through his house, the videotape, people sleeping, there is no sound in the film until he goes to jail.
Hmm. It's always kind of interesting. This is kind of why we're doing this, right? It's easy for me to go out on the internet or to talk to people I know who like his work. And then you're going to have a bunch of pretentious cinephiles discussing the reason why they are intelligent and they understand Lynch. And I don't profess to be intelligent. And I definitely don't profess to understand Lynch.
You're smarter than I am.
But this is always curious to sort of bring someone else into the conversation, be like, all right, this is what I liked about it. This is what I didn't get. This is what I did get. And that's kind of why we're doing this, is to get a vibe for that. Which, so in closing, I guess on Lost Highway, we don't like ranking stuff here. We don't really do that, but, you got something from this.
I got something.
It touched
from
you
it.
Somehow.
It did. I've heard of the film, and I heard good things about the film in the past. David Lynch himself doesn't turn me on as a filmmaker. He's been a little bit out there, but having sat down twice through this film to really understand what I was watching. I enjoyed it. I got something out of it that I didn't think I would ever have gotten. Trust me, unless you challenged me to watch it, I was never watching this film, especially the fact that I had to pay to watch it. So,
well, all right. So then that'll take us from 19 from David Lynch's surreal fever dream of a movie to Joss Whedon's very sculpted, very I don't want to say sanitized, but clearly well thought over. Every minute of the Avengers is a product of a corporate conglomerate, and this was the movie you gave me to watch this week.
Yes, it is, and now you are in my space.
All right, so Marvel movies. Your first one.
You popped a cherry.
No.
How do you feel about that?
Second. I saw Iron Man when it first came out, the first Iron Man.
Okay.
Liked it. My memory of it is that I enjoyed it. But there's a little bit of backstory here before we get into the movie. You and I, though we did not grow up together, we both grew up going to comic book shops.
Yes. Yes, we did.
I spent a lot of time in comic book shops. I did not, as a consequence, spend a lot of time talking to girls. But I did enjoy my time in comic book shops, and I grew up on Spider-Man, Batman, the Avengers to an extent, Daredevil. I was a big Daredevil guy. Okay. And for years, I remember talking to my friends, and we would all, you know, sort of fantasize about an era when these would become movies. And they never did it right, right? Like even...
You are preaching to the choir. I can't tell you. Me and my friends, nerds that we were, used to talk about this all the time.
Right, that
about,
one day
about seeing these films, yeah, absolutely.
And you know the Sam Raimi, who played the first Spider-Man? Not Topher Grace.
No, Tobey Maguire.
Tobey Maguire. The Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies. I like the first one. I didn't care for the second one. I don't remember the third one.
The third one was not good.
That was with Jamie Foxx as Electro.
No. So there are three generations of Spider-Man films since 2002.
Yeah.
So you have the three Raimi films.
Yeah. Who is the villain in the third Raimi film?
There were three of them. That's why it was terrible. You had Topher Grace as Venom.
Yes.
You had what's his name as Sandman.
Thomas Hayden Church.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. I appreciate that. And then you had somebody else. Oh yeah, you had James Franco as the Green Goblin part two.
Oh yeah, because he was playing Willem Dafoe's son, right?
Yes, yes.
All right, so
forgettable.
So since then, and the first Iron Man came out in 2008.
Yes.
And since then, I don't know what happened. So after Iron Man, there was the Incredible Hulk with Ed Norton.
Yes.
I don't think that's well thought of now.
No. I want to point out that movie was put out by a separate movie company, a different studio, like I had said last week. And it wasn't until the very end, the first post-credit scene in that film, where they were connecting the two films together, basically making a shared universe that became this huge juggernaut of the MCU.
Okay, and now you raise my problem with these movies. And okay. it is not about the quality of the movie. So the Avengers, watched for the first time this morning. It is a finely crafted piece of filmmaking, right?
Okay.
Like it's got an arc, it tells a story. It's interesting visually, if not a little sanitized somehow. It's almost a little too perfect in a way, and I blame that on all the computer shots.
Okay. Okay.
But my issue with the Marvel Universe at large, and I've explained this to you and we've had discussions about this, is the nature of what Kevin Feige and Marvel are doing is they are creating this shared intertwined universe where technically, if I wanted to really experience the Avengers, I should have watched in order Iron Man, Incredible Hulk, Iron Man 2, Thor, and Captain America, the first Avenger.
Yes, that is correct.
And yes. They feed these into the other, right?
Yes, there are some parts, some movies more than others, and some movies will just give you the post-credit scenes where they are connecting them to the overall arcs of the series. But you should have watched the other five first.
Okay.
And we said why we weren't going to do that, because I don't want this to be a Marvel show. We're not reviewing Marvel movies. You know, 26 of them is, would be ridiculous.
Right. Now, you said something twice that I perked my ears up on. Okay? Okay. You've mentioned the term post-credit sequent twice. Okay.
Yes.
Now, here's my thing. Is I feel like Marvel, the worst way to look at Marvel films and the worst effect of this storytelling avenue that they've taken is, in a way, the film itself loses importance as a story, as an experience, because they have conditioned viewers to care more about what this movie sets up. You have to see Doctor Strange before you see the new Spider-Man Homecoming or Far From Home or Going Home, whatever the new one.
Yeah.
Okay. Because because Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange plays a role in that movie. Everything ties together, and what it does is I feel like it cheapens the experience of the individual movie as an experience, because it is always working towards what is coming next. The next time they can get you to drop $18 at an IMAX theater, the next time they can drag 2 hours out of you on Disney Plus, it is always geared towards keeping you in this continuous cycle of an experience that you feel obligated to be a part of.
Okay. Well, two things. One, good on them that they figured out a way, a formula to keep us riveted and interested and waiting with bated breath for the next film to come out.
Is it good?
Yeah. I mean, it's good for me and good for maybe younger Jason, who read these comic books and realized then, like I did and all my friends, that we were reading a shared universe. That is what Stan Lee and Jack Kirby put together when they started the Fantastic Four. And the first time there was ever any shared shared characters was when the Hulk showed up in Fantastic Four 14 or something like that. That was the first time that they ever shared characters from what they had created. Therefore, the Hulk lived in the Fantastic Four universe, and it wasn't long before now you had the Hulk joining the Avengers, and the Avengers teaming up with the Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man trying to join the Fantastic Four. All that was by 1965. So we have 30, 40 years worth of stories that we all loved, that we would love to have seen on film, and they finally did it. I can't be any happier.
And you know what? Everything that you say should resonate with me. And I should be thrilled to be able to see these characters on a screen in the way that I only could see them on the page and in my mind. And yet for some reason, like the Avengers is the first time, I guess, they get the band together.
Yes.
And yes. I feel like this movie came to life at really the only point, the first time it really came to life is when all of them are on the flying aircraft carrier, which is just as a visual and as a really cool image. Yeah, super cool.
Yeah.
But the first time when they're all on the bridge of the carrier and they're all kind of engaged with one another, and Robert Downey Jr. Sort of owns the space because his Tony Stark is a great character. The most interesting part of this movie, I thought, was when none of them are wearing armor and they're all shooting the shit with each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
The problem is
regular people.
Right. Or not even regular people, but they're people with powers who are maybe trying to be regular. Not even that, but they're people that are trying to engage with others.
Well, they were never able to work as a team beforehand. I mean, Tony Stark, they said it, Samuel Jackson's character, Nick Fury, said that he doesn't work well with others. They wanted Iron Man, but not Tony Stark, because Tony Stark can't work well with others. all of them had not worked in a team setting before, and this was them trying to get together as a team.
I wasn't a fan of the Iron Man comics. Was Tony Stark in the comics this sort of womanizing, ironic?
It's funny you say that, because when Iron Man came out in 2008, he was at very best a B character in the Marvel Universe. He really was. At that point, Civil War storyline had come out, and he had come to the forefront a little bit with Captain America. However, up until then, he was a B character at best. Was he a womanizer? Yes, he definitely was. He definitely had an attitude. He had an amazing mullet from 1985 to 1995. It had to be seen. It was a chef kiss. But he definitely was that type of person, type A personality. Had famous alcoholism issues written by David Michelinie, or Michelin, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it, that everybody knows about. So the way that Robert Downey Jr. brings his character to the screen, he has become Iron Man. I mean, they even draw him to look like Robert Downey Jr. now.
And I'm okay with that, because Downey draws the eye. Downey is a charismatic actor, and he's given a great performance. I thought Chris Evans was a little, I don't know, flat. And I know that the Chris Hemsworth version of Thor doesn't really come to life until Taika Waititi gets his hands on him with Ragnarok.
His tone totally changes 100%, and for the better. Not that he was bad; he was just very Shakespearean, and that's maybe because of the direction of the directors. The first one was Kenneth Branagh, it was very Shakespearean. The second one was considered one of the worst movies that they ever made. Very little. It gave very little to the overall arc of the MCU. But the third one with Taika Waititi was fantastic. The comedy. And Chris Hemsworth is naturally a very funny actor.
Yeah, and I could see, knowing what I know, because again, I haven't seen these movies, but of course, the Marvel Universe is so pervasive in our pop culture landscape.
Right. You can't escape it.
I'm aware. Like, I knew going into this that I was going to witness the Battle of New York. The final climactic, 30-minute CGI fest that takes place outside of Grand Central.
Right.
And that wasn't bad. And this is my takeaway, is that there's nothing I could look at this movie and trying to be as objective as I could and say it was poor filmmaking or bad writing or terrible acting, but I came away from it empty.
I think because you don't have anything invested in the characters at this point. And that's the drawback, once again, of giving you the tent poles of the MCU like I'm going to give you, rather than have you watching all of them. By this point, when I saw this movie in the movie theater in 2012, opening night at midnight with my 7-year-old daughter, it was something that I had put in a lot of time and effort in, as did all of these screaming, clapping people that were with me at midnight that night. So we had something invested in it, and which you don't. However, my hope and goal is when you are at the end and watching the final film that I give you, when the time comes, you will feel something, because you will have seen these characters enough and I guess gotten to know them well enough that when things happen, you will feel it.
I'm not yet. I'm sure I would. Agent Phil Coulson's death didn't hit me quite the way I suspect it might have hit other people. Poor Clark Gregg. But
he was great. Love that guy. Single-handedly brought the Avengers together.
I think the other issue with these movies is I'm drawn by nature to darker stories. Like, the Batman is by far my favorite comic book character of all time. And when the movie started, Disney Plus streaming it, upper left-hand corner, PG-13.
Right.
And a lot of people die, but you don't see a lot of blood.
No,
and I'm not saying that I need blood, but I am saying that New York City, a good chunk, New York from 48th to maybe 33rd Street, from river to river, is wiped out by this. But do me a favor. Who were the bad guys? Who was this army that Loki brought through the portal?
The army of the Chitauri was the army given to him by... Can you tell me who it was given to him by?
Thanos?
It was. That Thanos was the guy pulling the strings.
In a post-credit sequence.
Exactly. Oh, boy. I can't tell you how everybody screamed like fangirls that we were.
Is that Brolin? Is that Brolin's first appearance?
That actually it was not. It was not his first appearance. His first appearance came in 2014 in Guardians of the Galaxy that summer. Beforehand, they knew that they wanted to bring Thanos in. But wait.
Hang on. No. Guardians of the Galaxy came out after the Avengers. I'm looking right now at the Wikipedia. The Avengers came out May 4th, 2012.
Yeah.
Guardians came out August 1, 2014.
I know. That's what I said.
Right. So I said, this was Brolin's first appearance.
No, that's not Brolin.
Okay. So I'm saying, okay. So I'm sorry.
Thanos' first appearance. Yes.
It's Thanos' first appearance.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay, cool. I understand now. I'm sorry about that. Keep going.
No, it's okay. Not a problem.
The Chitauri. Expound upon this mindless horde of maskless fodder.
They were fodder. They were basically cannon fodder, but they needed to be menacing enough and plentiful enough that they would cause serious worry to the Avengers and anybody else that was in their way. You saw that poor waitress there at the practically crying towards the end of the movie. I mean, everybody was scared of them. So,
I think you're also scared of the giant winged lizard spaceship creature snake that was.
Well, yes. Yeah, those were kind of spooky, also. I agree.
Cool. As a conception, so really, really well done. Like just visually, like the way it moved through the city in between the skyscrapers, really cool. Like all of it, inventive visual filmmaking.
So, what you get in this film, what you learn later on, is how much it impacted not only New York, and you still feel the impact of New York to this day in the movies. Obviously, in 2012. Just last week, Hawkeye was released on Disney Plus. The first 5 minutes of the first episode was what happened in 2012 through the eyes of one of the characters in Hawkeye, who becomes a main character in Hawkeye.
You know, I think that it says a lot that you and I right now are watching Jeremy Renner TV series, except I'm watching Taylor Sheridan's Mayor of Kingstown, and you are watching Disney Plus with Haley Steinfeld.
I mean, this is what makes us us. We're doing this show.
Listen, I'm not judging it.
You're judging.
No, because it's not right. Like, listen, here's the thing, is I'm clearly in the minority. This movie made, according to Box Office Mojo, I think this movie worldwide made like $1.56 billion with a B dollars.
Yeah, it's in the top 10. It's in maybe in like 4 or 5. Or it's up there. I looked at the numbers myself the other day, so I don't have it right in front of me. But it's in the top 10 of the highest grossing films of all time, and I believe Marvel has at least 3 of them.
So
how's
clearly,
that? How's that for insane?
Right. Clearly, they know what they're doing in terms of how to create an event.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But I wonder if an event and a movie are incompatible. Not a movie. I shouldn't say that. If an event and let me say this, for a movie to be this popular and to land with so many people, it has to go through so many producers, so many layers of approval, so many checkpoints where a questionable decision or taking a chance in one direction or another is not going to work. And supposedly you just saw Eternals.
Yes.
And that's kind of a departure for them. And by all accounts, it's made a lot of money, but it's getting real bad reviews.
It's getting real bad reviews because it's definitely gone away from the formula that they have been used to, that a lot of us are used to seeing. And these are and have always been fringe characters in the comics.
Okay, so you just said it right there, formula. And that's what these movies are, right? Like, we know, and if you're into, like, how movies are written, you know that there's kind of a formula, the whole Robert McKee story and his sort of way of writing movies and Save the Cat. There's a formula. There are acts. This goes back to Shakespeare. There's the, you know, stories have an arc. So I get that. But I worry, I shouldn't say I worry, all of this is really not bullshit in the real world.
But well, of course, it's not going to affect you that much.
It affects me in that movies like this have created an expectation where movies like Lost Highway could not get made today.
And that's a shame. And that really is a shame because I understand, we make fun of each other, but I really do understand your point that it does take away the creative freedom and artistic spark that independent directors, or really all directors are independent directors when they first start out until they hit it big, quote unquote, air quotes, but it kind of takes away from them. And maybe we have not seen over the last 10 years those types of movies where we are shocked or we sit wondering what the film is about. And again, I like to be spoon-fed. You like to think. And, you know, Lost Highway to me was definitely a thinker movie. And I'm sure that you didn't have to think too hard while watching Avengers.
No, but I'm not downgrading it. Like, they do make it accessible so that, like, I didn't see the first three movies prior to Avengers. I did see Iron Man, but that was a long, long time ago. I haven't seen those movies, but it's also, like you said, it's not like I was sitting there going, wait, what's going on? I did have, there were like two moments, the Chitauri, I obviously didn't understand, but I got that Loki was sort of employing them as a means of taking over the Earth and assuming this godlike stature that he's after. And they did do a good job of laying the relationship between him and Thor, his brother adopted.
Right, so you didn't have to see Thor really to get where they were coming from, where the friction between the two was happening.
No, they did a good job of that, and that's sort of the thing that I'm looking at my notes here, and I had a bunch of notes, and they're all really flimsy, and they're not really deep, meaningful. They're just observations, and then I realize there's nothing. Not that I go into a movie looking for something wrong. This movie is perfectly fine in every way. And yet, when I turned it off, if I didn't have this podcast, I don't know when the next time is I would think about that again.
Okay. I mean, I get it. It's understandable. I know when the next time you're going to think about it again is, but although without the podcast, you're right. It wouldn't happen.
And the other thing, like what you're talking about, is that different directors, like these people get sort of drawn into this this corporate churn of putting these movies out. Like guys like Ryan Coogler and Chloe Zhao, like Creed is one of my favorite movies of the last 10, 15 years. And Chloe Zhao does a quiet, beautiful film like Nomad. And their next projects are Black Panther and Eternals. And Black Panther, by all accounts, is a great movie.
Yeah.
But
and really, I mean, it was a really game-changing movie, I felt.
Which?
Black Panther. Much more than Eternals was put out to be, that it was going to be all diverse, and it's the first film with these types of characters. I believe that Black Panther was much more of a film that pushed the boundaries of where Marvel was going, and everybody accepted it.
And you know what? As long as you make a good story and you tell a good movie, I'll you know, that's all that matters in the end to me. But my worry is that, like, creatives like that, like these young, really inventive filmmakers, they're not. I shouldn't say that because this is just, who am I? I'm just another schmuck reading the blogs. But they're going from doing these kind of interesting movies to, again, not to be judgment, the movies that I'm not as interested in. It's all subjective. It's just, I would like to see them doing something else.
Okay. Do you think that these filmmakers regret making these films? Once they've, quote unquote, hit it big with Nomad or Creed or, Catherine Bigelow making her movies, I'm sorry, not Catherine Bigelow.
Patty Russo.
The woman who did Wonder Woman. I apologize.
Yeah, Patty Jenkins. Sorry, Patty Jenkins. Yes, okay. Patty Jenkins.
I mean, do you think that they regret making these big budget events?
No, I can't speak for them. I don't think they. I mean, I don't know. Like, you can't get in the head of any one person.
No, but they grew up. Not grew up. Okay, let's just say they are part of this generation where these films are at the forefront. Whereas your Coppolas, your Lynches, the people who complain about these Marvel films, and we've spoken about them, the Scorsese, what he says about them, they were not available. That these types of films, whether they be superhero or any kind of big movie events, were not available to them back in when they were up and coming directors.
Can I blow your mind?
Go ahead.
Do you know that David Lynch turned down directing Return of the Jedi?
I think I did know that. Which is you know, amazing to me because he was only on the scene for how long? Eraserhead came out when? 76, 77?
Yeah, but then he did Elephant Man.
Yes, Elephant Man 1980. So, you know, by 1983, everybody knew what Star Wars was. The Star Wars brand was already huge. But perhaps he just wasn't. He was already Lynch by then when he knew that he would not be happy making a commercial film.
But, and you know what? Maybe this is what ties both of these movies together and sort of where we were in 1984 and where we are now. David Lynch goes out and he directs Dune for Dino De Laurentiis, and he doesn't get final cut, and the movie is imperfect. I think it's interesting to look at, but it's clearly not a very good movie. There's a lot left out.
And he says, well, I mean, people think that it's not the vision that he wanted it to be.
Correct. And so what he does is he steps away from that traditional Hollywood system and he goes off and does his own thing for the next 40 years. Whereas...
And it's worked.
And it's worked for him. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, you know, you have Ryan Coogler makes Fruitvale Station and Creed. Mm-hmm. And then he does Black Panther. Chloe Zhao does Nomadland. She did another movie before that whose name escapes me. And mm-hmm. then she does Eternals. And we don't know where these people are going to go. We don't know if they're going to do the whole one for them, one for me, where they do a passion project and then they do another Marvel movie to pay the bills. But
Right.
You know, I wonder, I don't know. I mean, Give me the Kraven the Hunter Spider-Man story. Give me a good Daredevil movie with Duke. Nuke was the
Nuke. Absolutely, yeah. Frank, you know, Miller. That was Born Again. That was the Born Again storyline in 1986.
Yeah, like right now, I'm looking at where the upcoming films in the Marvel universe, right? And you have what's going to clearly be the biggest movie of this year: Spider-Man No Way Home.
Yes.
And then there's Sam Raimi is back on board. I guess he directed the next Doctor Strange movie.
He did. It was originally supposed to be more horror, but they reeled it in. They reined him in a little bit, for lack of a better word. And it's not going to be as much of a horror film as he wanted it to make it. However, he is back on board.
Yeah. And then there's way down the line, another Thor, another Black Panther, Guardians 3, another Ant-Man movie. But I know. And then there's a Fantastic Four. They're going to tee up Fantastic Four one more time. They're going to take another swing at that ridiculous curveball of a story that no one can get right.
But it's amazing they can never get that right.
Yeah, but I mean, hey, listen, Avengers, absolutely nothing wrong with the movie. I thought it was quirky. It was fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously. Big fight scenes. But again, for me, the moments I like best are when they're not in their armor and they're a bunch of people in a room talking. And that probably says more about me than it does about the movie.
Okay. I think you got out of it everything you were going to get out of it. I didn't think you were going to be like, oh my God, that was, you know, it was so much more than I thought it was going to be. I think you've been around long enough. These movies have been around long enough that you knew what was coming.
Yeah.
And it was really just a matter of getting the story in front of you. And I didn't expect anything other than this. So I'm happy you got something out of it. And I'm happy you didn't hate it.
Yeah, man, I had a good time. I really did. I can't complain about it. But again, I think I still go back to thinking that I enjoyed these stories more when I was a loser kid with pimples sneaking these comics on.
Definitely,
you know, under.
Definitely not a loser. Don't worry about it. I still read them.
So that pretty much ties it up. Lost Highway and the Avengers. Arco, do you know what you are challenging me with for next week?
Yes. I came up with this immediately because I don't want to give you Marvel every single week. I'm not going to do that to you, not to the listeners. And but I do want to get one more big franchise under your belt. And
okay.
I think this one is going to be the one that is really going to pain you. So I'm actually looking forward to hearing what you think about it. So
all right.
You're going to go with, I'm challenging you with Michael Bay's Transformers.
Oh, dear God, no.
The first one, which, listen, I the whole point is to give us each other movies that we liked, not just movies just to hurt each other. And a little secret, I did like the first one a lot. I looked forward to it quite a bit. And hey, listen, you have some big names in here. You have Hugo Weaving as one of the characters. So how bad could it be?
I don't know. Michael Bay, his hands are all over it. So
yeah, he definitely is.
All right. So the first Transformers, that's for me, right?
First Transformers, yes. And yeah, I mean, you if your wife comes down watching you, and watches you watch this movie, she may ask questions, but
I'm sure she will.
Sure.
Actually, she decided years ago not to ask questions.
Smart woman.
All right. All right. For you, I thought about this for about 30 seconds right before we came on the air, so this is not as well formed a challenge, but I'm going to give you Nicholas Winding Refn's Ryan Gosling starred strange descent into the Thai underworld. Or Cambodian, no, not Cambodian. Only God Forgives.
Only God Forgives. How come I've never heard of this film before?
Probably because Ryan Gosling has, I think, 16 lines of dialogue, and he is the star, just so you know. The star has less than 20 lines of dialogue.
Okay, all right. Well, listen, if you're giving it to me, it obviously is a good movie to watch. And I just saw a Ryan Gosling movie the other day.
What'd you see?
One of my favorites. Now that I'm talking about it, oh my God, Jason, was a film that we both like.
With him?
Yeah, and Steve
Crazy
Carell.
Stupid Love.
Yeah, Crazy Stupid Love.
Oh, what do you mean we both like? I don't know what you're talking about.
You said you liked that
Shut
movie
up.
A lot.
Shut up! Shut up! I have
lie.
An image to uphold.
That was a great film. I loved it.
It's a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, all right, I'm looking forward. Challenge accepted.
Yeah, challenge accepted. Next week, we're going to be doing the Transformers and Only God Forgives. So
okay.
Until then,
yes.
Arco, thank you very much for exposing me to the Avengers.
Okay. Jason, thank you very much for exposing me to David Lynch.
And we will be back next week. Thank you for listening. And please tune in to the next episode of Movie Challenge Accepted.